Blog Talk Radio.
Deanna Spingola, and this is the Spingola Zone, and I'm going to get a hold of our guest. We were having a little bit of trouble before. There was kind of a tick on the line, and I hung up to see if I could get it to get rid of that tick, and it didn't work real well. So anyway, we got to call our guest. I guess our producer is going to have to do that because let's see. Hang on just a minute. I got to give our producer the phone number so that he can call our guest, who is James Perloff today. And I'm very happy to have James on the program. He's I've interviewed him a few times before, and he's a wonderful guest and has written a couple of really great books. Anyway, that's who our guest is going to be, and his books are. He is the author of several books, one of which is The Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and The Shadows of Power. James, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay. When I heard that tick and we hung up, then I couldn't call into the studio again. So anyway, our producer, thank goodness for our producer. He's just fabulous. And I see that the tick is gone, so I don't know what it was. But anyway, this
program... You got rid of the tick, but not me, huh?
No, we have you, thank goodness. And so, anyway, this program is sponsored by the American Free Press, which is a wonderful newspaper. Their website is AmericanFreePress.net. I have been a subscriber for some time, and I have also been a subscriber to the Barnes Review, whose website is BarnesReview.org, and that's spelled B-A-R-N-E-S, BarnesReview.org. Please visit both websites and support the people who go to so much trouble and all their efforts to report accurate history as well as contemporary events. My websites are Spingola.com and SpingolaSpeaks.wordpress.com, and that is a site that one of our listeners created. Jim, I can hear you breathing. Don't stop breathing. Just don't breathe too much into the mic. There we go.
Yeah, heavy breathing. That's usually not a sign of a friendly caller, so I'll make sure I stop that. Amy, I'll move the phone a little further away from my mouth.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm glad you have sensitive equipment. I mean, it means you won't be missing anything.
Okay, we're going to take questions and calls. You can ask a question, comment at Spingola.com, or you can join the people in the chat room, which is Spingola.chatango.com. And we will take calls in the second hour at 347-215-7292. And we will, and James's website is James Perloff, and his name is spelled P-E-R-L-O-F-F. Okay, I think we're good to go. And you're going to be talking about the Lusitanias today and how the American people were manipulated into World War I. And it's very timely because, it's almost been 100 years. So.
That's right. It'll be the 100th anniversary of the assassination at Sarajevo this month, assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. But, you know, before we start talking about that, Deanna, I'd actually like to put the spotlight on you for a minute. You know, I've been a guest on your show, I think, maybe four times before, but mm-hmm. I had not read your books. And as with this show upcoming in the Lusitania, I thought, well, I should see what Deanna has written on World War I. And I ordered, went into Amazon and I ordered your books, both of the ruling elite books. And I ordered the second one in Kindle because I wanted to have it in time for the show, and I ordered the other one, the hard copy. Let me just say, I am truly impressed at the work you've done. There is such a volume of information there. It is so well researched. My book has about 200, my new book, Truth is a Lonely War, has about 260 footnotes. You have about 2,000 footnotes in each book. You have documented everything. Your books, I think, should be on everybody's shelf because they're like an encyclopedia. You know, I had somebody ask me if I could write a piece on the Armenian genocide, which was a suggested topic for his website, and I said, well, you know, that's how I'll look into that. I don't know anything about it. You have a tremendous amount of information in there on the Armenian genocide, so many topics. You have really done us a service by covering comprehensively the true story of events over the past centuries. And I know you've got another volume coming out, but I just wanted to thank you for doing that, and I just want to recommend that people buy your books, The Ruling Elite.
Yikes, I'm embarrassed.
Well, I'm impressed. I'm impressed. You know, there's no typos in there. I couldn't find a typo, and, you know, and when writing a 700-page book, it's pretty hard not to have a typo in there. You've done an amazing job. It's well-written. It's clear. And you've gone on digital, and maybe this, I know your schedule's been cut back, but maybe that's a blessing. Will that enable you to work more on the third volume?
Well, actually, the third volume just went live on Amazon a couple of days ago. And
okay.
So it is ready. They just put the image up probably on Saturday, and they don't have the e-book up yet, the Kindle version of it up yet. But I'm finished with book three, and I'm now working on another book, which will be finished. Hopefully, it won't take as long as the other books. It won't be 700 pages. I don't.
Well, I may ask this third book. Through what time frame or year does it go? The third one. Does it bring us up to present time, or where does it go to?
Actually, it's about current events. It's about Sandy Hook. I'm not certain of the title yet. It might be violence, a national epidemic, another look at Sandy Hook. That's kind of my proposed title, but it's not for sure.
I noticed you've been posting a lot on that, and given that this recent arrest that took place of a Sandy Hook truther, you may be getting at what may be a situation where people were set up. Is that perhaps your take, that truthers were set up on this one?
No, not necessarily. Now, are you talking about Mr. Halbig being arrested?
No, I didn't even read the story, so I shouldn't comment on it. But somebody in the truth movement apparently stole some items at the grave site, thinking that there was nobody buried there. And AOL, American Online News, was making a to-do about that, and it was really cast. They used the word truther, and it was sort of casting truthers in general in a bad light. And I know that you've had some disagreements with some of the people's analysis of Sandy Hook. and I haven't formed a definite opinion, but I do have a lot of respect for your views, which I know are very considered.
I was not aware of that arrest, and certainly anybody that that destroys property is you know, that's not the right thing to do. If you have a an issue based on documentation and based on fact, but even if people did believe that no one's buried there, no one has a right to destroy property. And heaven forbid, oh my gosh, to think that people would destroy grave sites is just the most egregious thing.
Let me just interject. I don't know that they destroyed a grave site. I just saw something about a truther who thought that no one was killed had done something in relation to the grave sites. I didn't read the story, so I probably shouldn't have commented on it. But it just brought you to mind, because I know that you've challenged some of the interpretations of Sandy Hook.
Well, I believe that when people are going to try to prove something, that they should use valid information and not use looped videos, not use out of context comments or video to try to piece together what they believe to be true. I believe that you should really document what you believe and have something valid behind your statements, and not speculation and not theory.
Absolutely, because when you speculate, you're really setting yourself up to be proven wrong later.
Sure.
So you really want to be sure of your facts. And that's one reason why it's sometimes good to be looking at historical events when we've had enough time to get the information in and make a major decision based on a lot of data. But there's something else I wanted to say about you before we start. And I wanted to thank you, because I think this has cost you something. I wanted to thank you for telling the truth about World War II, because that is something that a lot of people who are otherwise involved in the truth movement or in challenging socialism and active in American conservative causes will never do. And, you know, one of my challenges, actually, Deanna, is, I give PowerPoint talks on the subject of my books, and I'll talk about false flags, and I'll talk about Pearl Harbor, and I give a talk, for example, to a group of young professionals at the invitation of someone who really, most of them had never heard this before. But then I got the inevitable question, you know, well, wasn't Pearl Harbor justified, and didn't FDR do what he had to do because we had to stop the Germans, right? And, you know, I don't like that question, not because it can't be answered. I only don't like it because I can't answer it in a couple of minutes. There's no way to give a soundbite answer, because that, more than any other event, has been indoctrinated in the minds of the American public. You know, when I wrote The Shadows of Power back in 1988, not even being aware of this myself, but there was a quote I had in there from the historian, Dr. Charles Beard, who took a contrary view to the establishment, and he wrote this in 1947. He said, quote, "The Rockefeller Foundation and Council on Foreign Relations intend to prevent, if they can, a repetition of what they call in the vernacular the debunking journalistic campaign following World War I. Translated into English, this means the Foundation and Council do not want journalists or any other persons to examine too closely and criticize too freely the official propaganda and official statements relative to our basic aims and activities during World War II. In short, they hope that, among other things, the policies and measures of Franklin D. Roosevelt will escape in coming years the critical analysis, evaluation, and exposition that befell the policies and measures of Woodrow Wilson and the Entente powers after World War I." Unquote. Now, that's a very significant quote from Dr. Beard, and it putting it together, you can see that they really did that. World War II, they were taking no chances. They didn't want any Harry Elmer Barneses around to challenge World War II as it happened to World War I. And that's why I think we've seen this barrage of incessant information or misinformation regarding World War. I mean, how many Hollywood movies about? They're still making Hollywood movies about World War II, but you almost never see one about World War I, even though it was almost on a comparable scale in its own time.
Oh, absolutely. I think that it was simply a continuous war with a 30-year grace period in between, because
correct.
I see it as a revolution. And in fact, I believe that it was Winston Churchill that says, well, this was, or was it Roosevelt? They were both collaborators in this whole event, as they were in World War One. I mean, these two cronies managed to participate in both wars, and in World War One they had basically the same position in the government, and same thing for World War Two. And it's just amazing what these two scoundrels have done to the world. And they need
exposure. They're emblazoned as heroes. And people talk about Winston Churchill being a symbol of courage, not aware of the fact that he would lamb it out of London, would he not, when he British intelligence had tipped him off that Germany was going to bomb London, and he would leave his fellow Londoners to take the brunt of the bombs. Well, he sat comfortably at Chartwell, did he not?
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. There's this continuity of personnel, which is often quite remarkable, and it's interesting that Franklin D. Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy when the Lusitania went down on the American side, because Churchill was heading the Admiralty in Britain, and they were distant cousins. And it's also interesting that Franklin D. Roosevelt's cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, was in the same position, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, when the USS mm-hmm. Maine exploded, triggered the false flag that brought us into the Spanish-American War. And isn't it interesting that after these gentlemen had these positions, they both then became governor of New York and then president of the United States. Don't you, there's a continuity when you say a continuum.
Yes. Yes, it is just amazing what these two families have done. And so anyway, it's just I did a timeline because I think timelines are very important. So I did a timeline. It's on my website. I was going to put it in the book, but I was I did not want any more pages in the book, so I put it online. And it's kind of a work in progress because every time I see something that's relevant to the book, I actually went through book two and book three and picked up all the dates and what happened on that date. And so the document became very lengthy. And but when you look at the timeline and you see the things that occurred in a particular, like 1897 or 1914 or 1933, I mean, those years were so significant in terms of what was going on, what was happening, who was declaring, you know, economic war on whom. I mean, it was just timelines, I think, are really good.
Well, I think they are very valuable in that they show you the sequencing of events, because there is an agenda to this. It's not happening by chance. And you start to get an idea of what their game plan was when you see it in sequence.
Right.
Not just as isolated events.
Right. Right. And they did such a cover-up after World War One. Herbert Hoover had a group of people, maybe 1,500 people. They went through Europe, and they collected documents, anything that would incriminate the actual culprits that started World War One. They collected all of these documents, and those went into the Hoover Institute at Stanford. And they're pretty well lost to history unless you happen to know about them and want to get in and look at what's going on, or what went on. But they wanted to conceal the culprits of World War One so that nobody would find out. And, of course, they did the same thing in as you mentioned, after World War II. They wrote the official history, and none dare question it, because that was official. And as you mentioned, the movies, they continue to make claims about World War II. And when you look at the number of films that were made about the Holocaust, oh, my goodness, and they're still making them, still to this day. And of course, Hitler is a perpetual enemy. He's the devil incarnate, and it's very difficult to counter that. But I attempted to do that.
Right. It does take that a tremendous amount of documentation simply because of the false documentation or the false support of their arguments. They've gone to such lengths. It shows you how much they attach a lot of importance to World War II. And so I think we should attach a lot of importance to discrediting those lies. If they think it's that important to lie about it, we should think it's that important to tell the truth.
Exactly. Absolutely. Even if you lose friends and family. Because I think...
Or you maybe lose some radio time, too. That, I don't know if that was the case, but I know that your schedule was cut back recently.
Yeah.
And
it was.
Perhaps that has something to do with your quote-unquote controversial subject matter. I don't know. But I just wanted to thank you and acknowledge you for taking a very courageous stand. And on what we just said is they consider it an important issue, so we know it is an important issue because it shapes a lot of what people believe today about, you know, why the State of Israel exists and why we do what we do. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, well, thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate it. I don't usually promote myself. It makes me feel uncomfortable, though.
Well, you know, that's natural, and that's good, and we're not supposed to praise ourselves. When we do that, people don't like it. It sounds vain, and you really don't promote yourself as a result. You really promote yourself as a self-serving person, but I'm glad to have an opportunity to mention your books. They really should be on anyone's shelf, even if they seem too long. I don't want to read a book this long. You want it on your bookshelf as a reference, so when there's something you don't know about, a phase of history that you need information about, you can turn to Deanna Spingola's books and find that. And so I was just overwhelmed when I had not looked at your books before, and I was just amazed at the volume of research and your discernment of the truth that enabled you to draw correct conclusions from that research.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. All right, let's talk about the Lusitania. That is just a very important topic and one that everyone should know about this.
Yes, because false flags, if it was just one false flag, it wouldn't matter too much, would it? But they keep bringing false flags. Last year, you know, the Syrian chemical weapons used allegedly by Assad, you know, they'd never stop with a false flag. So the Lusitania, of course, was a British passenger ship, and in May of 1915, it was on its way from America, from New York to Liverpool in England, and it had about 2,000 passengers on board, including almost 200 Americans, and it was torpedoed by a U-boat, and there was an explosion from the torpedo, and that was followed moments later by a massive explosion in the ship, which weighed 32,000 tons, was beneath the waves in just 18 minutes. And there were 1,200 people who died, and that included 128 Americans. And although this did not produce the immediate declaration of war that they hoped for, it was the most important in a series of pretexts that were used to eventually get that U.S. declaration of war against Germany. And, of course, it was portrayed as wanton slaughter, vicious slaughter of women and children, a cowardly act. And actually, go to my website. I have just click on the blog. There's a major piece on the Lusitania. It's got more than 40 graphics, including a lot of the propaganda posters showing, you know, these children at the bottom of the ocean, and men, it's your duty to enlist, avenge the Lusitania, remember the Lusitania, we shall not forget. Don't those sound a little bit familiar, those phrases? In our more recent times. But that was the main pretext that drove us towards the war. And we should probably talk about why did the Germans torpedo the ship in the first place? And it goes back, actually, to what happened at the start of the war. When the war began, Britain initiated a blockade of Germany. And, of course, it's pretty hard to blockade England because it's surrounded by the ocean. But what they did was they placed a lot of mines in the North Sea, and the British, of course, had a superior fleet, able to hem in the Germans, and they wouldn't allow neutral merchant vessels to pass. They even regarded food, powdered milk or flour, as contraband. And, you know, even by conservative estimates, as you know, several hundred thousand people died of starvation in Germany from that blockade, including a lot of children. And so from Germany's viewpoint, since their supplies, and you've got to have supply lines in a war, since their supplies were being cut off by Britain, they wanted as best they could to cut off Britain's supplies, and their best means of doing that was through the U-boat. But the U-boat was not attacking neutral shipping at that time. They were specifically targeting belligerent ships, British ships. The Lusitania was targeted, of course, because she was carrying many munitions. I should mention that when the war started, and they started this naval blockade of Britain through the U-boat, U-boats would always surface first. They would follow international rules, we'll call the cruiser rules, that had been established at places like the Hague Conventions, and they would allow the crews to escape in lifeboats before they sank it. Sometimes they would torpedo it. They might want to save a torpedo. They might use their gun to sink it, or they might even plant bombs on board. But they would always mercifully allow the crew and passengers to escape. And you can even see some video of that on YouTube. But why did they stop doing that? Why did they start torpedoing without warning as they did with Lusitania? And that takes us to our friend Winston Churchill. He decided unilaterally as head of the British Admiralty that he was going to revoke the cruiser rules on Britain's part, and he made an offense, a prosecutable offense, to halt a ship or surrender it to a U-boat. And I'm going to quote what Colin Simpson, the British historian, wrote in his book, The Lusitania. He said, quote, "From October 1914 onward, a steady stream of inflammatory orders were issued to the masters of British merchant ships. It was made an offense to obey a U-boat's orders to halt. Instead, masters must immediately engage the enemy, either with their armament if they possessed it, or by ramming if they did not. Any master who surrendered his ship was to be prosecuted, and several were," unquote, Colin Simpson. I should mention not only were there prosecutions, but one merchantman was given a bounty of $3,300 for ramming a submarine. Now, Winston Churchill was arming these subs, and, you know, these subs were not designed as battle warships on the surface. They were relatively fragile, so just one shot from a low-caliber cannon could sink a U-boat. And by the time the Lusitania went down, several subs had been sunk by merchantmen, and Captain Walter Schweiger, who commanded the U-20, which sank the Lusitania, just narrowly escaped an attempted ramming. But let's talk a little about, let's get more into Churchill here and the things he said that revealed the strategy and why he was doing it. He wrote this to Walter Runciman, who is president of the Board of Trade. He said, quote, "It is most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores, in the hope especially of embroiling the United States with Germany," unquote. It's a little familiar, right, from World War II as well. And then in his post-war book, the post-World War I book, The World Crisis, Churchill wrote this, quote, "The maneuver which brings an ally into the field is as serviceable as that which wins a great battle. The first British countermove made on my responsibility was to arm British merchantmen to deter the U-boat from surface attack. As the U-boats were forced by the progressive army of the British mercantile marine to rely increasingly on underwater attacks, they encountered a new set of dangers. The submerged U-boat, with its defective vision, ran the greatest risk of mistaking neutral for British vessels and thus of embroiling Germany with other great powers," unquote, Winston Churchill. So we can see what he's thinking here. He's thinking that, you know, they have to look through a periscope. Sooner or later, they're gonna mistake American ship for British, sink it, and America's going to be in the war, slam dunk. But it didn't work that way because the Germans were not obliging. They're very scrupulous about avoiding sinking American ships, and he didn't get what he wanted. So what's the next best thing, Deanna? If you can't get them to sink an American ship, the next best thing is have them sink a British ship with Americans on board. And to that purpose and objective, he assigned Commander Joseph Kenworthy of the political section of British Naval Intelligence to prepare a report on what the political results would be of just such a sinking.
Right. Live bait. He wanted live bait.
Right, that's what they called the ships that were so easily sunk by the U-boats, was live bait. He used that term, of course, himself once in reference to the Lusitania in 1913.
Right. Well, I just, you mentioned the images, and I just love these images that you have included. And apparently they were very effective in getting people to enlist and in telling people or in brainwashing people about what they should think. And it's amazing that people got into this.
Well, you know, this didn't occur to me until just now, Deanna, but, you know, we're used today to television and internet and a lot of images, and they create an emotional impact on people watching them. But in those days, there was no television. They didn't even have radio yet. And so these posters that you see were probably the main means of visually stimulating people's emotions. And of course, they did make movies then, silent films. And I don't know if you got that graphic I sent you. It's also in my article. But it's from the movie The Cry of Peace, The Battle Cry of Peace, made in 1915. And it shows these Huns invading New York City, and they're grabbing and groping these girls.
Yes. Oh.
But all of that was to stimulate, of course, the hatred of the Hun, and, you know, to persuade the person that these are, you know, these are people that are out to get us, and we need to do something to stop them. And if you'll enlist, you can be part of this grand crusade.
Right.
We should probably talk a little bit about the foreknowledge of the attack, because this is also what's another clue in piecing together the evidence that this was indeed an intentional false flag. You've written, I know, in your book about Walter Hines Page. He was our ambassador to Britain under Wilson,
mm-hmm.
very ardently pro-British. And he wrote this to his son on May the 2nd, 1915, 5 days before the Lusitania was sunk. He wrote, quote, "If a British liner full of American passengers be blown up, what will Uncle Sam do? That's what's going to happen," unquote. And that is from the Life and Letters of Walter Hines Page, which you can find that quote right online. You can see the whole book. You know, it's great to have these old books now in a format
yep.
where you can actually flip the pages online. But
yeah.
he is saying it might happen, it's going to happen. And I find it interesting also, he said that the ship's going to be blown up. He didn't say sunk or torpedoed, he said blown up, and which of course is exactly what happened.
Sure.
And, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it was blown up because of all the explosives that they had in that ship, which was against the law. They were not supposed to, an American ship, which actually it was an. Let's see, no, it wasn't. It was created by the what company made that? Same company.
It was a Cunard line. It was British, but it was against American law for Americans to passengers to be on board a ship carrying munitions, explosives.
Right, right. And it was made. The Titanic was also created by the same company, I believe. Anyway.
I think that was the White Star, but there are analogies people have drawn between these two events. They're pretty close in time,
yeah.
and there are some individuals. I mean, the same. Justice Lord Mersey oversaw the inquiries on both.
Yeah. I'm just.
And another very telling quote was from. I know many in your audience know that Edward Mandel House was Woodrow Wilson's controller, President Wilson's controller. He represented Wall Street. He lived in the White House most of the time, and he was called Assistant President House by Harper's Weekly. And he was called the Unseen Guardian Angel of the Federal Reserve Act. He was from the banking community, although he originally was from Texas. He'd been in the banking community in New York for 10 years before Wilson was elected president. And Edward Mandel House, at this time that the Lusitania went down, was in Britain as special emissary of Woodrow Wilson. And on the morning that the Lusitania sank, he met with the foreign minister of Britain, Sir Edward Grey. And here's what he writes. And this quote you'll find in the intimate papers of Colonel House by his biographer Charles Seymour, member of Skull and Bones. Here's what House himself wrote. He said, quote, "We spoke of the probability of an ocean liner being sunk, and I told him if this were done, a flame of indignation would sweep across America, which would in itself probably carry us into the war," unquote, Edward Mandel House. But this next one's even more telling. Now, the two of them proceeded to Buckingham Palace, and they met with King George V. Now, this is about 2 or 3 hours before the Lusitania actually went down. House wrote this, quote, "We fell to talking, strangely enough, of the probability of Germany sinking a transatlantic liner. He," meaning the king, "said, suppose they should sink the Lusitania with American passengers on board," unquote, mm-hmm. King George V, quoted by Colonel House.
Wow. Wow.
That is two or three hours.
Go ahead.
No, that was 2 or 3 hours before the ship went down, and how can we discount that as coincidence?
Yeah, big coincidence. And of course, the Germans were also aware of these plans, because they did post they wanted to post a big notice in the New York Times telling Americans not to sail on the ship. And of course, the New York Times did not publish that until the very morning of the sailing. So it was not very effective. And of course, and then there were other people who were warned beforehand, don't sail on the ship. Otherwise, you're going to die. Boy, we're having a really big storm here. Can you hear it in the background?
I can hear rain, heavy patter of rain, yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking about a pretty stormy and dark subject, and let me just quote that. Notice that the German embassy intended for actually 50 American newspapers. It was notice in capital letters with an exclamation point at top, and they asked this to be printed next to the shipping notice section of the newspapers near the Cunard notices, and it said, quote, "Travelers intending to embark on the Atlantic voyage are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and her allies and Great Britain and her allies. And the zone of water includes the waters adjacent to the British Isles. And that in accordance with formal notice given by the Imperial German government, vessels flying the flag of Great Britain are liable to destruction in those waters, and that travelers sailing in the war zone on ships of Great Britain do so at their own risk," unquote. That was a notice they wanted posted, and that was suppressed by the U.S. State Department. And it's interesting that the representative of the Germans finally got an audience with William Jennings Bryan, who was the Secretary of State. And I'll say this much for Bryan. He was one man in the Wilson administration. Of course, he quit soon thereafter because of all of this. But he cleared that notice for publication, but it's getting very late at that point. And William Jennings Bryan went to Wilson, and he asked him to please himself warn Americans not to board the Lusitania because of the obvious risk. But Woodrow Wilson would not do so. Isn't it interesting that the Germans tried to keep Americans from getting hurt, but the American president did not?
Yes. Isn't that the most egregious thing? They just don't care. They are quite willing to exploit the feelings of the Americans by having a few thousand or a few hundred of them killed in order to perpetrate warfare. That is just mind-boggling. Absolutely.
Represents a spiritual depth to these people that these people sink to, and when you consider that it happened with the Maine, and when you consider it happened with Pearl Harbor in 9/11, you just see this repeating trend create a situation where someone does something or appears to have done something to us, and then tell people they've got to avenge this foul deed that has been to us, done to us, and people don't find out simply because the same controllers that control the president also regulate the meat and own the media.
Right. Yep. And it's certainly indicative, because they did not post these notices in the newspaper, and if they had, it would have been would have kept a lot of people from traveling on that ship, of course. It would make the Germans look pretty good if they had posted them, because it would show that the Germans were considerate and concerned about the welfare of the Americans, and we certainly don't want to have that.
The last thing they wanted was to bring America into the war. The last thing they wanted was for American passengers to be on board that ship. But what Churchill was giving them was a catch-22. Because, you know, there were 6 million rifle cartridges on that ship. There were over 50 tons of shrapnel shells and a lot of other armament. And the catch-22 was this. If you don't sink the Lusitania, all these munitions are going to go to the battlefields in France and kill German soldiers. If you do sink the Lusitania, we're going to make you out to be murderers of innocent women and children, so you take your pick. There was a catch-22. There was no really good choice for the Germans in this case, except to try to keep Americans off.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good point.
I was going to mention that there was a big dinner being given for Edward Mandelhouse the very night that the Lusitania sank, the day that it sank, and at this dinner there were a lot of British dignitaries. Of course, Edward Grey was there, and when the news came that the ship had been sunk, House arose and announced that the U.S. would be in the war within the year, which of course it wasn't. He'd overestimated the way Americans were going to respond to this, but our friend Walter Hines Page, who I should mention, by the way, Walter Hines Page, while he was ambassador to Great Britain, was on the payroll of Cleveland Dodge, who was the number one financial backer of Woodrow Wilson. He was a munitions dealer. Of course, he made great profits during the war. And he paid Walter Hines Page $25,000 a year so he could live in what they called proper ambassadorial style. But isn't that also what you call a bribe, to give a public official a private,
yeah.
You know? But Walter Hines Page, the day after May the 8th now, the day after Lusitania went down, Page cabled Wilson, and he said, quote, "The freely expressed universal opinion," he's speaking from Britain, "is that the United States must declare war or forfeit European respect. So far as I know, this opinion is universal. If the U.S. does come in, the moral and physical effect will to bring peace quickly and give the U.S. a great influence in ending the war and in so reorganizing the world as to prevent its recurrence," unquote. Now, I find this cable from Page remarkable because it shows what they're already envisioning. They're envisioning that after the war, they're going to restructure the world, and they've already got the League of Nations in their sights. It shows you how everything is working according to a plan, an Illuminati plan.
Absolutely. Sure.
We should probably talk a little bit more about the contraband again, why it was justified to sink this ship. The Lusitania had been built. Cunard built her with financial assistance from the British government, along with her other ships, like the Mauritania. And they also provided, the government provided Cunard with annual subsidies for the maintenance of these ships. And the condition was, in time of war, these ships can be converted into auxiliary cruisers. And that's exactly what happened. The Lusitania was plated once war was threatening. And she was given gun mounts. And you know, Deanna, there is controversy about whether or not the Lusitania actually had cannons. There is some testimony that she did, and some people have written on Lusitania hotly deny it, but there is some testimony that she had cannons concealed on her lowest deck where passengers were not allowed to go. But she was listed in Jane's Fighting Ships as a auxiliary cruiser, and that is something a U-boat commander would keep on board to identify ships. And another reason, besides being an auxiliary cruiser, why she was a legitimate target was, we mentioned she had 6 million rifle cartridges, 50 tons of shrapnel shells. She also had 46 tons of aluminum powder. This was an explosive that the British military used, and that was destined for their Woolwich arsenal. And she also had at least 15 tons of gun cotton, which was headed for their weapons testing establishment,
okay,
and that was used in their mines.
James, we lost you for a few seconds. At least I.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Interruption here. That's okay.
What was the last thing that I said audibly?
I think it was a storm. You were talking about the cannons that might have been on the Lusitania, and then all of a sudden you weren't there.
Okay. That harp will get you every time, you know. Yeah, I was talking about the contraband that was on board. I think there's a lot we don't even know about. We know for sure, though, that we're talking about why it was a legitimate target, besides being an auxiliary cruiser, which she had 6 million rifle cartridges, over 50 tons of shrapnel shells, 46 tons of aluminum powder, which is an explosive the British military would use. It was destined for their Woolwich arsenal, and also at least 15 tons of gun cotton, which the British used in their mines.
Right.
Are you still there?
Yes. What is so interesting, too, is the date that they started building these ships. talks, well, that implies, foreknowledge, that implies that they were getting ready for war. That this was, because they started, the Lusitania was completed in 1907, the Mauritania in 1906. And the government actually subsidized Cunard with money to keep both of these ships ready for war. And so you know that this was in the plans for several years, as you mentioned.
I've got to think that this war was planned for a long time. You look at these complex alliances that, you know, it was kind of strange looking back on it when you think that this whole thing began with a conflict between Serbia and Austria. And somehow out of alliance commitment, suddenly you've got the French fighting Germany on a bloody battlefield and trenches and millions of men dying. There's got to be a lot of manipulation to have created this war, and it does take long-term planning. And I'm sure that you're absolutely right that when they made Cunard promise to make these auxiliary cruisers upon their building, they already had the war in sight. In fact, in 1913, the year before the war began, Churchill met with Alfred Booth, who was the Cunard chairman, and told him that war would begin with Germany, and he predicted the date as September 1914, which is only off by 1 month.
Right, right, absolutely. And, of course, you brought up the assassination when we began the program, you talked about the assassination of Ferdinand. And my goodness, when you think about the people who actually committed the assassination and their ties to Freemasonry, it's just all very interesting.
Yeah, you know, I was once talking to a wealthy banker type about these things, and I mentioned to him the fact that the Archduke was assassinated just 6 months after the Federal Reserve Act passed. And he said, well, how can you possibly tie the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand to the creation of the Federal Reserve? Well, when you realize that Paul Warburg, who founded the Fed, was a 33rd degree Grand Orient Freemason, and that there's a lot of evidence that the assassins who carried out the assassination were, in fact, Grand Orient Freemasons, you don't have to be stretching things too much to understand that there's a secret, you know, legally secret organization working behind the scenes. And we're not saying this is just Freemasonry. There's even forces behind Freemasonry, as we know. Sure. But you can see how Hidden Hands can coordinate the Federal Reserve on one side of the Atlantic and an assassination on the other side. And, of course, the Federal Reserve made it possible to fund that war along with the income tax, which had just been passed.
Sure. And they couldn't have done it without that. They had to get those two things going in place, so that they could manipulate the war, fund the war, and the money really flowed. I mean, the money flowed out of this, the gold flowed out of this country and into England. And it's amazing how they worked together. And of course, they worked together formally since 1897 and decided that they were going to share the plunder that they obtained, and they've been doing that ever since.
What's interesting, when I was researching the Spanish-American War 2 years ago for an article I wrote on that for the New American Magazine, it was interesting. I just stumbled upon this Anglo-American League. And it was established in the summer of 1898, which is right when the Spanish-American War was going on. And at that time, I realized that that was when the Anglo-American establishment began. The Anglo-American League, founded in 1898, became the Pilgrim Society, which is one of the parent organizations of the Council on Foreign Relations, still exists today. David Rockefeller and Queen Elizabeth are members. But that was really when it all began, and that alliance was very much in place. And I have to think that when the Lusitania went down, they had the Maine in mind. I think they were looking back on that, Dan, and saying, well, look at the success we had when we sank an American ship and the outrage that was created and how it triggered a declaration of war, or at least armed intervention in that case, between the United States and Spain. And I had to think they were building on what they regarded as their previous success.
Sure. Well, Page, a gentleman that you mentioned, the ambassador, was a member of the Pilgrim Society, as have every president and secretary of state since the society was created in America. It was it actually started in England, and then they opened a chapter over here. But since they created that chapter here in this country, that every president and every secretary of state have been members of this secret society up to this day.
And that shouldn't happen, should it? In a free society, these things should be publicized, and no elected official should be engaged in secretive conferences and secret groups with people from other countries. That, in fact, I believe that is what they call a violation of the Logan Act, which says that everything has to be above board, and you cannot conduct secret negotiations that are not at the behest of your government or open to public disclosure.
Sure, and Kennedy certainly spoke about this, not too long before he was assassinated.
Well, in regards to the Lusitania, another thing we could talk about was how they set this up. And, of course, there was no guarantee that Schwager would pull the trigger on a torpedo. There was no guarantee that a U-boat would sink her, but there were certainly probabilities, and they certainly created a very intense probability that the Lusitania would be sunk by a U-boat. The British knew the locations of most of the U-boats, and this was for a couple of reasons. One was they had cracked Germany's naval codes, and so when a U-boat would surface and it would communicate with its home base, they could pick up that radio signal, and you know they couldn't always pinpoint exactly where a sub was, of course, but they would know its destination, and what its general area of operations was going to be, and what its mission was. And they also knew about the U-20, which sank the Lusitania, because it had sunk ships in the Irish Sea. This is the sea between England and Ireland. It's the route that the Lusitania had to go through to get to Liverpool. And the day before Lusitania was sunk, the U-20 sank two smaller steamers. So they definitely knew that the U-20 was there and that it was a danger. Now, on May the 5th, this is 2 days before the ship went down, Churchill met in the map room of the Admiralty with his first Sea Lord, Admiral Lord Fisher, and also present was Commander Joseph Kenworthy, who I mentioned before, from British Naval Intelligence. And on this grid map, were pins representing the location of each British ship and each hostile ship that was known about. And there was a pin for the U-20, and there was a pin for the Lusitania, and they were on a direct collision course. And after the war, Commander Kenworthy wrote, quote, "The Lusitania was sent at considerably reduced speed into an area with a U-boat, where a U-boat was known to be waiting and with their escorts withdrawn," unquote.
Right.
And
right.
The escorts are really significant here, Deanna, because it was standard practice to have destroyers accompanying an important vessel like this. In fact, on previous voyages where there was a submarine threat, there would be destroyers accompanying the Lusitania. But on May the 7th, there were four destroyers lying idle in Milford Haven, which was a nearby port. No destroyer went out to meet the Lusitania. The only ship assigned to meet her was an old cruiser called the Juno. And the Juno was actually recalled to the port of Queenstown on the southern coast of Ireland by the Admiralty on the grounds that as this old cruiser was too vulnerable to submarine attack. So when the Lusitania came into the Irish Sea, you know, Captain Turner, the captain of the ship, told his passengers, "We're getting nervous." He says, "Don't worry, tomorrow morning we'll be in the hands of the Royal Navy." But when morning broke, there were no destroyers there. The Royal Navy was not there. Captain Turner was alone in the Irish Sea with a U-boat on the prowl.
Wow. Wow. What an awful situation. And apparently he was not aware of the plans that the governments, the cooperative governments, had for that boat, for that ship.
It's interesting that there are records of that there were wireless communications between the Admiralty and the Lusitania, but they've all gone missing. Other files have not gone missing, but the actual transcripts of the messages sent between the Admiralty and the Lusitania are all gone. And some analysts suspect that Captain Turner requested permission to reroute the Lusitania, and he was refused it because they're hiding something if those files are missing. I should mention that there are three ways they could have protected the Lusitania and prevented this. One thing they could have done would have been to reroute the Lusitania around the north of Ireland, because that's another way to get to Liverpool, and there were no U-boats operating up there, and they knew that. Another thing they could have done, they simply sent it to Queenstown like they did with the Juno. And the third thing they could have done would have been to send out the destroyers to escort her. But, you know, the destroyers were not even looking for the U-20 as they should have been. They were just sitting idly in port. And I'm really grateful that Patrick Beasley wrote his book, Room 40. Patrick Beasley has a chapter in there on the Lusitania. He was an officer in British Naval Intelligence, and he was actually the man who had moved the pins on that map I was talking about in the Admiralty map room. He was the guy who had moved the pins for Churchill. And he was considered the leading authority on the history of British Naval Intelligence. And here's what he writes in Room 40. He said, quote, "Nothing, absolutely nothing, was done to ensure the liner's safe arrival. I am reluctantly driven to the conclusion that there was a conspiracy deliberately to put the Lusitania at risk in the hopes that even an abortive attack on her would bring the United States into the war. Such a conspiracy could not have been put into effect without Winston Churchill's express permission and approval," unquote. Patrick Beasley. Wow. And you know, Deanna, if you and I use the term conspiracy, we're called conspiracy nuts, conspiracy buffs. But here, Patrick Beasley, the man who moved the pins on the map for Churchill, used the word conspiracy twice to describe his actions in regard to the Lusitania.
Right. Well, it certainly was. It absolutely was. And a conspiracy is when two or more entities decide to do something without divulging to other people, and that certainly qualifies what they did to the Lusitania, what they did to the USS Maine, numerous other conspiracies that you can that you could probably name. Yeah.
And certainly in this case, we have more than two people.
Oh. You think that...
More than just Churchill and Roosevelt.
Sure.
And Wilson.
Certainly the two people that were so instrumental, but then you have to figure in Colonel House and all the other people. And they were all on the payroll. Like you mentioned, Page was getting $25,000 a year, which in that time period was a small fortune. And so
over half a million a year, right?
Sure. All of these people were paid to be part of this. And so you have to consider, okay, these people were benefiting financially by their participation. But then there were probably a lot of other people who were not as high up on the echelon of secrecy, in the group, who were very compartmentalized, and perhaps were just told to just, okay, you do this, and you have a lot of people who probably never communicated with each other, who all had a small part in this, that really had no idea that they were going to be part of something awful.
Right, and I think you've made a very important point there. In secret societies, people quite typically swear oaths of absolute allegiance. And what often happens is they'll get instructions to do something, and they don't get the full lowdown on why they're being asked to do it. They only know that they've received many benefits, high-ranking positions, wonderful homes, all kinds of cash benefits, prestige, media praise, and so forth. In return for that, they give unquestioning obedience to orders, and they may not know specifically what's up, but they do carry out those orders obediently, and that's one of the values of secret societies to the Illuminati, is this this aspect of obedience.
Right, and of course, Freemasonry is the same way. And
a perfect model.
Unfortunately.
We should probably talk about speculation on why the ship went down in 18 minutes, because you can be sure that and in fact they were, that the U-boat was as surprised as anybody was that the ship went under. You know, the Titanic was about 2 hours before it went down, but you got a 32,000 ton ship. It was struck by a torpedo. Now this class of torpedo had 278 pounds of explosive. How does a 278 pound explosive bring down a 32,000 ton ship in 18 minutes?
Exactly.
And they tried to claim on the British side that maybe the boilers exploded, but, you know, we know that that's untrue because there were sailors who survived from every one of the Lusitania's boilers. If they'd exploded, there would have been no survivors.
Yeah.
The explosion came from the forward part of the ship where the munitions were stored. And I don't know if this is an accurate explanation, but in Colin Simpson's book on the Lusitania, he brings up that there was an affidavit signed by a chemist named Ritter von Rettig, who was on the payroll of Captain Guy Gaunt, who was the British naval attaché in Washington. And 2 weeks before the Lusitania sinking, according to this affidavit, he was called to see Guy Gaunt, and he asked the chemist, he said, what would be the effect of seawater coming in contact with gun cotton? And he explained that there were two types of gun cotton. There was a relatively inert, stable kind, and there was another kind called pyroxylin, which was very unstable, and he described how the seawater could cause chemical changes that would make it explode. And unless it was shipped in something watertight. Now, the very next day, we know that Gaunt went to DuPont, the arms manufacturer, and thereupon DuPont shipped tons of gun cotton to the Cunard wharf. And we know from a law firm collected statements from dock workers and shipping men that they had loaded this onto Lusitania. On the manifest, it was listed as 4,000 40-pound bags of butter and cheese. And we know
gosh.
But this butter and cheese was not in a refrigerated compartment. Its destination was marked as a box belonging to the Royal Navy's weapons testing establishment, and nobody ever filed an insurance claim for the missing butter and cheese. We know it's not butter and cheese. But just to balance this, it was shipped in burlap, okay? So it was almost a sure thing that if the reaction von Rettig predicted took place, there was a very good chance it might explode. Whether or not that was Gaunt's intent, I don't know, because they say that the Germans were trying to buy up these containers, watertight containers that normally gun cotton would be shipped in. But what's very interesting, I find, that Simpson brought up was that after he made this affidavit, the chemist was arrested, and he was tried in camera. And he was charged with making statements prejudicial to the peace of the nation and was sentenced to prison. But mm-hmm. Captain Guy Gaunt, the British naval attaché, was promoted to rear admiral and knighted after all this happened. Now, whether or not this means Gaunt really had, it was just trying to find out about whether the shipment would be safe or whether he intended to help it make the Lusitania explode. There are a couple of other theories I should probably just mention. There's a book called The Lusitania Unraveling the Mysteries by Patrick O'Sullivan. He felt that it was the 46 tons of aluminum powder, which was also destined for the British military establishment, which is highly explosive, which the torpedo might have touched off. And Patrick Beasley, who we mentioned a little bit earlier, he thought that it might have been the percussion fuses for the shrapnel shells, which he said had a substance called mercury fulminate, which an explosion from a torpedo also could have set off. But who knows, it may have been something else, I don't know. But there were obviously a lot of things on board that could have touched off this explosion. Something set it off. We don't know for sure what, but it seems that the ship was set up to be blown up. And you recall that Walter Hines Page, the ambassador, in his letter to his son 5 days before the Lusitania went down, said a British ship with American passengers on board would be blown up, not sunk,
but
be blown up.
Yeah.
So it seems to be in their the main, which blew up. You know, the main just became this torn hulk of metal. 266 crew, most of the crew died from that massive explosion. They have to be thinking the same thing. I wouldn't be surprised if a similar mechanism was used. Why not use the same mechanism? Because nobody's ever successfully resolved definitely how the main was sunk.
Right. And there was a bunch of shenanigans around that, too, where they deliberately put things into that ship that would be explosive and that would sink it. I mean, it was all planned, just exactly the same way as the Lusitania. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. But 18 minutes, that is amazing that it went down.
You know, probably what the Germans figured. Now, this is the last torpedo Schweiger was going to use before he went home. He probably figured one torpedo, a ship like this, it's going to take a couple hours to go down. The ship will get rescued. The passengers will escape in lifeboats. He wasn't anticipating this massive explosion and loss of life. But it sounds as if somebody was. And I should mention this, too. We should talk about the cover-up. We did a show on Pearl Harbor, and we talked about the cover up there, and that was some kind of cover up in America with the Roberts Commission, and we can touch on that in relation to the Lusitania because the same people are involved, some of them. But after the Lusitania went down, there were 1,200 dead, and hundreds of bodies were being washed up on the Irish shore, and the Admiralty sent a instruction to Vice Admiral Koch. He was there. He was in command of British defenses in the sector that he commanded from Queenstown. And the order said, quote, ensure that bodies selected for the inquest have not been killed or mutilated by means which we do not wish to be made public. Now, what means could that be? They've got to be thinking about the shrapnel and or the other munitions on board. You know, the British tried to claim that these were empty shrapnel shells, but, you know, divers who've gone down to Lusitania recovered some of those shrapnel shells, and they were loaded with lead ball and powder. So they were designed to explode, and they had the element of shrapnel inside. And also, although it may not have affected anyone physically, there was a survivor named Joseph Marichal. He had been an officer in the French army, and he distinctly heard the sounds of cartridges exploding. So they've got these munitions in mind, and they tell them not to allow any bodies to be used for the inquest. They've been mutilated by means we do not wish to be made public. What other interpretation can we put on that?
Sure. Well, you just want to get people who drowned. You don't want any evidence of shrapnel or any explosive kind of a mechanism, you know, anything like that. Wow.
They're covering their bases.
Sure they are. And, of course, they did convene a commission. I mean, that they always do that.
Right. That was inevitable. And that's where the scapegoating comes in. This would be held under Lord Mersey, who, as we mentioned, oversaw the Titanic inquiry. Well, of course, before that even happened, the Admiralty did its own investigation. So Richard Webb, who did the initial report for the Admiralty's trade division, the decision was clearly made, Deanna, to blame the skipper, Captain Turner. And Webb wrote, quote, "One is forced to conclude that he is either utterly incompetent or that he's been got at by the Germans," unquote.
Oh,
and this report went to Admiral Lord Fisher, the first Sea Lord, and he said of Turner, quote, "He is not a fool, but a knave. I feel absolutely certain that Captain Turner of the Lusitania is a scoundrel and been bribed. I hope that Captain Turner will be arrested immediately after the inquiry, whatever the verdict or finding may be." And then he added in his notes, "Ought not Lord Mersey to get a hint?" the justice. Then Churchill, reading these reports, said, quote, "We shall pursue the captain without check," unquote. And then Webb of the Trade Division wrote to Lord Mersey, and he said, quote, "I am directed by the Board of Admiralty to inform you that it is considered politically expedient that Captain Turner, the master of the Lusitania, be most prominently blamed for the disaster," unquote.
And you can draw some comparisons between that situation where they blamed Turner and the situation at Pearl Harbor where they blamed two people there who have still not been cleared, even though their families came forward and asked Congress to reevaluate. Same thing. They blamed other people, and people who should have, who were totally uninformed about the whole situation. That's terrible. Terrible.
It's an exact parallel, and we've talked about this on your show before, but after Pearl Harbor, which Roosevelt and select officials knew about in advance, but not our military command in Hawaii, Roosevelt appointed a commission called the Roberts Commission, made up of friends and associates of himself and Chief of Staff George Marshall, which absolved Washington of any responsibility and laid all the blame on Admiral Kimmel and General Short, the military right. commanders. And when a subsequent independent Naval Court of Inquiry and the Army Pearl Harbor Board, which commissioned by Congress, found that Washington had foreknowledge of the attack through decoded Japanese intercepts, and they didn't even know half the story at the time. Those reports were quashed by Roosevelt and made top secret, and then he used the arm twisting of military officials to have those findings reversed. And it was not until after the war with people like George Morgenstern and Evan Robert Theobald and John Toland and other excellent people who wrote books on this, but still had even their findings suppressed in the media and that the media didn't give them any attention, did the public learn. But it seems that Roosevelt was following Churchill's example. Find a scapegoat, make the public think that you've examined this thing objectively. But it's just outrageous that Lord Mercy was asked to render a verdict before the trial even began, before he heard one piece of evidence, he was instructed to find Turner guilty.
Terrible. But that's the way they do it. They have to have a scapegoat. Whether it's a whole country that they scapegoat, or whether it's one person or two people, that's their strategy.
It is. And I should just mention the findings of the Mercy Inquiry was that the sinking resulted entirely from a torpedo. The hearing was held in camera. It was not open to the public. But Captain Turner was never even asked what his cargo was. And the fact that there were munitions on board was never brought up at the Mercy Inquiry. It was not discussed. But I will say one thing, that Mercy was not willing to crucify Captain Turner, and there seemed to be a couple of reasons for this. One was no evidence against the man was produced in court, and he couldn't bring himself to do that, even though they had a solicitor from Churchill trying to do his best. They tried to say that he should have zigzagged, and therefore he was blamed, but Patrick Beasley, in his book, he discovered that, in fact, no orders for zigzagging had been issued to the captains of merchantmen at that time. They did not have such orders. They tried to say they had in court, but he had not received any such orders. And the other reason that he didn't go after Turner may have been the fact that, fortunately, Winston Churchill had been sacked as head of the Admiralty because of the Dardanelles campaign, which was a disaster for Britain. So he was out of the picture, and you no longer had to placate him. And I think that might have also been a factor in Mercy's findings that did not blame Turner as much as the Admiralty wanted that to be the case. And I should also mention that after this, Mercy requested he be given no fee for his work on the Lusitania case. And he asked to be excused from further justice duties, and he told his children the Lusitania case was a damned dirty business.
Whoa. So he absolutely knew. Absolutely. Now, I wonder, Turner, we would expect that he probably was not aware of the cargo totally.
I would think that as captain of the ship, he had to be, Deanna. I think he had, maybe not all of it, but I don't think he could be in that position and without knowing of it. I think that he, as his attorneys were from Cunard, and he was probably told to keep his mouth shut and you won't get too severe of a penalty. That might be another reason, as a matter of fact, why they didn't graft him too hard, was that if he had, he might have opened his mouth and said, this was on board, this is what really caused the explosion. But that was all very severely suppressed. Any mention of munitions was just suppressed at the trial. Again, he was never even asked in court by any attorney what his cargo was, not by his own attorney or by the prosecutors.
Right.
That was off the table.
Now, of course, the whole purpose for World War One, and you talk about this at the end of your article when you refer to the Balfour Declaration, which was issued even before the war was concluded, because that was one of the purposes for having this war, as you indicate. Wow, this is a lengthy article. It's just a really You just have covered this so well.
Well, as you have done with all history, as I mentioned at the outset, with your books on the power elite, and I'm just so impressed and amazed. Those are going to be references of mine from now on. When I don't know about something, an area where I need more information, I'll be looking at those books and looking at your references.
Well, do you want to talk about a little bit about the Balfour Declaration, as you've mentioned in your article? You have so many details in here, and it's terrific.
And I felt that this needed to be done because, you know, Simpson's book was published over 40 years ago. It's out of print, and I just felt a lot of these details were kind of fading into memory. And also today, with the advantage of the Internet and the retrospect on more false flags we had, we can put things together even better than we could have, certainly, in 1972, the year his book came out. That's going to blow the lid off this case. But well, let's talk about the purposes of the war, including Balfour. But I wanted to mention In relation to the American Declaration of War, you know, it seems that Page and House were very confident they were going to get a Declaration of War out of this, and they were probably thinking of the Maine and how that just triggered war almost immediately. Mm-hmm. But the American people were not ready. That was the thing. They just weren't ready to go to war with Germany. And they, for one thing, there were a lot of German Americans in this country, and they were aware of the fact that Britain was the first one to violate the Kreuzer rules. It wasn't Germany. And one solicitor in the State Department said that, you know, it's clear that the British are mixing babies with bullets. And there's a point that needs to be made, too, is that, you know, Deanna, Americans could safely travel to Britain simply by getting on American ships. The Germans were not attacking American ships. If you wanted to go to Britain safely, all you had to do was get an American ship or the vessel of another neutral country, and you were safe. But Woodrow Wilson tried to make it out like this was some kind of some sacred right that Americans had to travel on the ships of belligerent nations without having any risk to themselves. And he said, you know, it's our sovereign rights have been violated by this act of Lusitania. Well, there was no precedent for that at all. In fact, George Washington had stated that if any American cargo ship tried to do business with a belligerent nation during a war they were neutral in, that they would not be under the protection of the U.S. Navy. And in fact, during the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, the British government advised its citizens not to get on vessels of those nations because they were doing so at their own risk. So all the precedent was on the favor of Germany. But Woodrow Wilson tried to make it out that there was this sacred right that we had to travel on these ships, which we didn't have. And as we mentioned, he wouldn't even warn Americans himself not to go on those vessels. Well, he couldn't get the Congress was not ripe for a declaration of war, but he tried to provoke the Germans into rupturing relations, and he sent them basically an ultimatum, and he demanded they stop submarine warfare, which, of course, ridiculous. That's the only real means they had of fighting against Germany with its on the seas, because their own fleet was pretty well hemmed in by the British fleet outside of the North Sea. And so the Germans replied, and they actually sent Woodrow Wilson a copy of Winston Churchill's orders to the merchantmen to ram or fire upon subs. And they also stated that the Lusitania was carrying all this contraband. And so Woodrow Wilson then replied to them, saying that they were misinformed and that America had scrupulously made sure that everything was safe on the Lusitania. Well, that's the point at which William Jennings Bryan resigned as Secretary of State. He knew that that was blatantly false because the collector of customs in New York City, Dudley Field Malone, another political ally of Woodrow Wilson, who was rubber stamping all these manifests for the British and for the Lusitania, pretending that they didn't have munitions on board. Dudley Field Malone had told Wilson that almost everything on board the Lusitania was contraband. And so William Jennings Bryan, Secretary of State, knew that the president was lying when he replied to the Germans. And so he refused to sign the reply, and that's when he quit. as Secretary of State. And, of course, they then got in Robert Lansing, which was a great relief, you can be sure. He was the uncle of Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, and that tells you something right there with the kind of pedigree that he had. He was the man they wanted in there all along. The only reason that Bryan became Secretary of State was he had been a contender for president. He had, in fact, been the nominee of the Democratic Party, and he agreed to help Wilson get the nomination, but in return from that, they had to promise elements of the Democratic Party that he would get a cabinet position. But you can be sure they were glad to get rid of him at this point. Now there was nobody in the way. But they couldn't get the declaration of war, and so they had to wait for another pretext. And while that was happening, the media fanned the flames with all these posters and these books being about Germany is going to invade us. And, you know, they made that movie I was talking about where they showed the Huns invading New York City.
Oh, right.
And isn't it interesting? Because I've not seen those old silent movies, but, you know, they did the same thing in World War II. You remember the famous line in Casablanca when Humphrey Bogart says, Major Strasser, there are certain neighborhoods in New York City I advise you not to invade. Remember that line? Maybe you don't. It's kind of a famous line from the film. But
I have not seen that movie for a long time, but yes, definitely. They made a lot of movies. Hollywood was certainly collaborating with Washington before. Well, I'm trying to remember some of the movies that they made. They came out with these horrible movies. And as you mentioned, they called them Huns, and then all the images that they produced, the posters that they produced, was terrible. All this propaganda was very deliberate, and they actually had a department where they created propaganda specifically to do exactly what they did. And so you have
the Department of War Information.
Yes, so you have to apply that to what is going on now, to what has gone on. Since that point, I don't know whether Americans think, oh, well, everything's been cleaned up and we don't have that kind of thing anymore. That is simply not true at all. It's gotten even worse. Oh, amazing.
Right. You got to have that potential enemy, that ever-present danger, and when one enemy is defeated, you've got to come up with a new one. That's why Harry Emma Barnes called it perpetual war for perpetual peace.
Sure.
But Charles Lindbergh, in the World War II context, pointed out how ridiculous it was. He said, you know, I'm not quoting him exactly, but he said, to stop all this hysteria about German invasion. You know, the Germans didn't have a single aircraft carrier. How can you have an invasion without air cover? And Lindbergh pointed out, if they tried to cross the Atlantic, invade our shores, invade New York City, where long before they reached our shores, our land-based Air Force would just go out and bomb them to smithereens. But in World War I, they were hemmed in port anyway. So the idea that the Huns were going to come over here and invade us was just absurd. But they needed this period of time to build up this hatred and fear of Germany to get that war declaration. Now, the Germans, after Lusitania, gave their sub-commanders, don't again ever sink a passenger ship without warning, because they wanted to keep America out of the war. So Wilson had to bide his time and wait for another pretext, and it finally came. March of 1916, a sub-commander was looking through his periscope, and he spotted an odd-looking ship, and he thought it was a mine layer, and he fired a torpedo, and it turned out to be a French passenger ship. This is the English Channel, called the Sussex. And the ship was not sunk. It was towed to port, and no Americans were killed, but four were injured. But how's a German sub commander to know that Americans are on board a ship? You know, it's so ridiculous.
Exactly.
But anyway, Wilson looked at this as a pretext for war, and he again tried to get the Germans to rupture relations, and he sent another ultimatum. At first, they were going to demand that they stop all sub warfare, but his advisor said that would be too extreme. So he said, stop present methods of sub warfare. So the Germans said, what do you mean by present methods? And he basically said, wanted them to go back to cruiser rules. He said, so the Germans said, okay, we will pledge to do that if Britain will pledge to do that. It will observe international law if Britain will. And it was conditional. And you've got to remember that when he sought his pretext of war, his resolution of war in April of 1917, he said Germany has violated its pledge to observe the cruiser rules. But what they neglected was the fact that Germany had made a conditional on Britain's observing the rules, and Britain had never gone back to observing international law.
Right. And that it's that collaboration that we talked about before. And I think that probably the this buildup of hatred and prejudice against Germany began in World War I, and they simply built upon it from that time forward. Because I don't think that they ever decided, hey, the Germans were not evil. They didn't cut off children's hands in Belgium. They didn't do any of these things. They just built upon them and created even greater lies, greater rumors. And remember that an atrocity story, if the truth doesn't work, then give them an atrocity story, and that works all every time.
It has been working for years, and, you know, Spanish-American War is a great example. They said that they were trying to, you know, National City Bank had targeted the Cuban sugar industry. They wanted to take it over and get the Spaniards out. So they started having stories in the Hearst Press about how the Spanish were roasting priests, and they were going out and throwing the Cubans to sharks. And these are all false stories invented in the newsrooms of the Hearst Corporation. His people didn't go out into the jungles of Cuba to see what was going on. But all these were fabricated, and they learned that a good atrocity story will really motivate, especially against women, you know, or children. And that's why you had to have the stories of the German soldiers cutting off the hands of and of course, you've always got to have it saying that they laugh when they do this. And so I think you brought out in your book how the news stories showed these pictures of Germans celebrating, and they said they were celebrating the sink of the Lusitania, but something else.
Sure.
And doesn't that remind you of the stories about how the Palestinians were supposedly giving children candy to celebrate 9/11? It's
sure.
The same. MO, it's the same technique, you know, just different personnel, different bad guys. It's the same methodology to get people angry enough to enlist and to agree to a war.
Sure. By the way, we will take calls. I'm sure that people have questions or comments. You may call in at 347-215-7292. And let me check my email and see if anybody has asked a question or made a comment. And, of course, the chat room. If you want to ask questions in the chat room, go ahead and ask them. Let's see. Do I see any? Let's see. Nope, I don't see any questions. Well, let's see a comment. In the 1890s, Theodore Herzl and other prominent Zionists wrote about the coming European Great War, about a border dispute from Serbia, but definitely a coming European Great War. And he also made the same comment, Trotsky and Lenin were Grand Orient Freemasons. They're definitely, let's see if we have an email question here or comment. One person said that there's a group behind all the problems, what fearless researchers all call them the synagogue of Satan. And you've certainly mentioned that in your book. We need to bring up your book, the name of your book. And it is available at Amazon. Now, it initially was available as a Kindle, and it is now available as a Kindle and as a paperback, correct?
That is correct, and the book is called Truth is a Lonely Warrior.
Yeah.
And I've attempted to write a comprehensive yet concise picture of this whole satanic movement, and the first chapter is called Six Wars, and it talks about the false flags and deceptions that brought us into six wars, starting with the Spanish-American War, and we have also the section on the Lusitania and Pearl Harbor, the Korean War, how that was artificially generated, of course, Tonkin Gulf and the Vietnam War and the Iraq War.
Right. I think we have a caller, so let's take a caller, or did he hang up? It looks like that person hung up. Did he hang
maybe
up?
Maybe we answered the question.
Okay, maybe we did. Okay. All righty, let me just check and see what our producer said. Okay, he just hung up. Well, too bad. If you would like to ask a question, please call back in. That number is 347. Okay, he did. He called back in. Okay, let's take the caller, 514 area code. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Deanna.
Hello, how are you?
Very fine. I've been
Good.
Listening with great interest, and I'd like to mention two names for your researcher, Alice and Albert Hubbard. Do they ring any bells?
Albert Hubbard was on board the Lusitania when it sank.
That's correct. He was the Walter, he and Alice were the top minds, top nationalist, patriot American publishers of the period. And they were en route to meet with the Kaiser to get his thinking on ending the war in 1915.
Ah. Well, Richard, I recognize your voice. You can't fool me.
You got me. Got me again.
Yes, I recognize your voice.
Oh, good.
Well, that is very interesting. And in fact, House was over in Europe, and he talked to the European leaders over there. And Germany didn't want a war at all. They were the nation that was least interested in having any kind of warfare. So they, you know, House knew this, absolutely knew this. And he went over there. He was there for about 9 months, stirring things up, I think.
And Alice and Albert published two magazines, and they were the highest regarded publishers of conservative nationalist America. And he did that story, the terrible story, The Message to Garcia. And that was American literature for probably 20 years. And so they were on the ship, and they were very close to the German-speaking population of the United States. And in fact, at that time, at the turn of the century, nearly half of the households in the United States had somebody at home that spoke German. So Hubbard and his wife Alice, they were both cooperating in publishing this publication. And so they were off on a peace mission, and we can only wonder what would have happened, had they met the Kaiser, and then he would have been able to bring back a story that might have ended the war. And so their murder, and I'm guessing it's a murder, the story of the Lusitania does back up. But I'm guessing if we had a James Bond in 1914, he would have been on the ship, and his job would have been to kill them and then to go over the side and be rescued. And you talk about sang-froid. That's real secret agent courage. But I'm guessing that the story is something like that and would make a great movie script if somebody could put it together.
I don't
anyway,
think
Alice,
that Hollywood would be doing that anytime soon, do you?
I don't think so either.
Dana, haven't got a deal already with Hollywood? I thought that Spielberg was going to make your latest book into a full-length feature.
Sure.
Okay, very good.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway.
Well, thank you for bringing that to our attention. I was not aware of that, and certainly it adds another element of why they sank the ship, and I'm kind of surprised that they would board that ship. Why would they board the Lusitania if there were other options?
Good question, but I'm guessing that there's so many variables there that possibly they thought they had a free pass. Because apparently they'd made arrangements by communication with the Kaiser that they were coming. And,
right, and if the Germans knew that people shouldn't be boarding that ship and shouldn't be traveling on the Lusitania, I'm surprised that they would, in as much as they had communication with the Kaiser.
Yes, so there's the story of the plot thickens. And so I went to their museum in East Aurora, New York, to look up. I was trying to get what his thinking was. What was the Hubbard's thinking prior to their departure? What was their editorial stance? And I got there, and it's all disappeared. There's nothing there.
Really? That's not surprising, but we'd like to think that it's surprising that they would do this, but no. Well,
anyway, I just thought I'd throw that into the mix and see what could go wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate that. I had not been aware that Hubbard was destined to meet with the Kaiser. It also could be that if he communicated that to the Kaiser, it's also possible that that message would not have been received by the U-20, because I'm pretty sure that at that point U-boat communication was such that if you were on the western side of England, that you would not be able to communicate by radio with home base in Germany. I believe that they had not developed their technology that far yet. So he might not have been up to date about something like that.
Well, how genuine is the U-boat record? Has anybody authenticated the fact that it was really there?
Well, there was a logbook kept, and I don't think there's any evidence that it was doctored, but they did keep a logbook, as any captain would.
Yeah, okay, of course, the captain would on his ship, but, I mean, he could have been on the North Pole or something, making entries according to instructions. Anyway, Discovery Channel did a deep sea inquiry into wrecked ships, and they went down to the Lusitania, and it showed the bottom all blown out of the ship. But there's munitions all over the place, scattered around on the ocean floor. They didn't go off. They didn't explode. So I'm guessing we have another level of inquiry here. The ship was pre-rigged for detonation.
And of
but something definitely exploded, but it's probably quite logical that a lot of munitions did not entirely detonate, that there was a percentage of them.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe they were
anyway,
in a different place in the ship.
Yes, right. Anyway, I'm guessing that James Bond has an origin deep in World War I history.
Well, you know, you're talking about James Bond maybe taking out Hubbard. It's kind of interesting that it's been said that T. Lawrence of Arabia, had intended to go to Germany, did he not? Also, perhaps, to see what could be done about alleviating the oncoming Second World War, and it's been widely said that he was removed by MI6 rather than a mere motorcycle accident, as was widely popularized.
Right. Anyway, I just thought I'd pass this along. It's a marvelous story, but I couldn't find his editorial stance, what his stance would have been at the beginning of the war and during that year prior to his trip. I thought that would have been really interesting editorial position for a publisher.
Right. He was the most famous man to go down on that ship, except perhaps for the Vanderbilt who went down.
Right. I think one of the Straussers went down, too. Or no, he went down on the Titanic.
Titanic,
anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd just kind of add this to the mix. Thanks for your program, Deanna.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right. Another email. And let me ask you a question. First, why do you think it is that Germany is such a target? I mean, they were the main target in World War I, the main target in World War II. They've been occupied since the end of World War II. What is it about the Germans that could make anybody hate them? As we've mentioned, a third of this country had German ancestry. What is it about Germany that makes them so hated by a certain tribe of people?
I think that they consider the Germans the greatest threat. I think that we're dealing with a satanic hierarchy, and we talk about the pyramid, the Masonic pyramid, and the Illuminati, and the Kabbalists. I think that, there's a passage somewhere in the protocols where it talks about the industriousness of their enemies, and I think they're I haven't got that in front of me, but I think that the Germans, as a industrious, intelligent, and courageous nationalistic people, were considered the greatest threat to their plan for a new world order, and therefore had to be subdued. That is what I think. But what do you think, Deanna?
Let me share what the writer of this email suggests. He suggests that the Germans are actually the tribe of Judah, and that the people who call themselves Jews but are not have an objective of wiping out the real tribe. Does that sound reasonable or not?
I'd never heard, you know, I've heard of British Israel. I've never heard about a German Israel or a claim, because to authenticate that, you'd probably need to see some Hebrewic, archaeological and evidence within German culture that they were coming from the Hebrews. So I've never heard that take before.
Right. Yeah. Well, they certainly are hated, and they are, they have, when you look at what they have given the world in terms of science, in terms of great music, in terms of great art, in terms of just the things that they have done, I mean, they're quite a group of people.
And when you look at those older pictures of the ruins of the German cities, the attempt to completely obliterate, you see that there was a tremendous hatred there, an attempt really at extermination.
Right.
The same crime that they're accused of doing themselves.
Right, right. This was absolutely an extermination. And then when you look at the Eisenhower death camps afterwards,
mm-hmm.
Where they held thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Germans, and they declared them as they changed the status from prisoners of war so that they could just put anybody behind that barbed wire. It's kind of amazing, this hatred for Germans in Germany. And I think it began not just in World War I, but before that, in the 1848 revolutions in Germany, or in Europe, the Marxist revolutions, and Germany was a target then.
Yeah, and I probably need to be reading your first book, which I'm sure covers that in detail.
Yeah, I do mention that. Yeah, so anyway, somebody suggested.
But I think that's certainly feared. That's certainly feared as an enemy and a threat to the ultimate aim of world domination and world government.
Yes. Now that is a factor, because I think that they are totally aware of the objectives. I mean, Hitler did throw out the bankers. He prohibited Freemasonry. Somebody in the chat room said that it was jealousy, and certainly that's a factor, I believe.
So something else I might mention too, when you look at Operation Barbarossa, you look at the resilience and strength of the German units in comparison. Their allies fought very bravely, but nobody held out with the resilience and strength of the German forces. They would not surrender. You know, they would not knuckle under like some of their allies did. And so I think that it's that strength. I think that has feared. And I think that's, you know, something that the satanic hierarchy was looking at. This is the ones we've got
I'm
to get rid of.
And
if you're in a battle situation, no matter which army, who do you want to go after? You want to go after the leader, right, of the enemy forces, the one that's the strongest, the one that's providing all the others with their leadership and guidance and strength and energizing them and motivating them, right? So if you were looking at what country you want to get rid of, it's going to be the one that's you regard as strongest, the one that's operating as your most natural enemy. That's, I think they feared it. And so they had to do everything they could to attack it, both physically and ideologically.
Right. And they were very disciplined. The German soldiers, there were some people, of course, rape is a part of every war. But if a German soldier raped a woman, they were immediately taken to trial or shot. I mean, you just were not allowed to do that kind of thing. And yet that was a big part of course, the Red Army. They raped 50,000 German females within a few months. And, of course, the Americans, I hate to say this, but the Americans also did that in Japan, in France. So yes, you are right that they did have, they were well-disciplined, they were courageous, and they were not equipped as well as the other armies. In fact, they had traitors in their own midst who were supposed to send supplies, send winter uniforms, because the Barbarossa started on June 8th, 1941, and, or was it 41? 41,
yeah.
They didn't intend to be still fighting in the winter, or if they did, they were going to have supplies sent to them, and the people who were in charge of sending the supplies did not do that. They held those trains back, and yet the Germans continued to fight and were very, very close to Moscow, and it was terrible. The traitors in Germany that prevented them from winning, and they were collaborating with Britain, with British intelligence. Terrible situation.
Do you include Martin Bormann in that category?
No, I didn't write about him. I mean, he's an interesting character, but there was I mentioned him, but certainly not as a traitor.
Well, I was just curious in that aspect of it. I don't think we should continue with the Lusitania.
Yeah. Back here.
Wilson finally got his declaration of war in 1917, as we said. And by the way, there are a few courageous senators and congressmen who spoke out against that declaration, but they were just too outnumbered at this point. But I'd just like to give one quote from Senator Robert La Follette. I didn't know much about him before I wrote on the Lusitania, but I'm starting to like the guy. He said, quote, 4 days before the Lusitania sailed, President Wilson was warned in person by Secretary of State Bryan that the Lusitania had 6 million rounds of ammunition on board, besides explosives, and that passengers who proposed to sail on that vessel were sailing in violation of the statutes of this country, unquote. So even in 1917 in the Congress, this was known. And by the way, there was an attempt to impeach Robert La Follette for making that speech.
Oh, yes. Isn't that terrible?
But they couldn't get away with it. I mean, William Jennings Bryan acknowledged that there's much you can do if the former leader of your party admits that that was the truth. They finally got it thanks to the clamor for war, and you know about the Zimmerman note.
Oh, yeah.
And which our British friends so conveniently provided us with. But as to the purposes of the war, you know, we were told that this would be the war to end all wars. Wasn't it successful at achieving that end? And didn't it make the world safer democracy? But I like to say it did make the world safer democracy in the sense that the Illuminati, they hate monarchies because the monarchies, whether it's the Tsar or Franz Ferdinand, they represent nationhood, they represent ethnicity, they're a figure around whom people will rally in defense of their land, and they make it hard to absorb the country into world government. Democracy, by dividing a country into parties, is inherently divisive. It splinters the country, makes it weaker and easier to absorb into your world government. That's my own view. I haven't met a lot of people who share it, but I think that's one reason. I think he was right in a sense when Woodrow Wilson said, we'll make the world safer democracy, because the kind of democracy they're talking about, they're talking about the kind of democracy where they control the printing presses, and they know how easy it is to get 51% of the vote when you got all the money and all the media under your control.
Oh, that's very, yes, that's, I've never thought of it in that way. But certainly the wars were designed to get rid of the monarchies. And, even though the English monarchy remained intact, they were certainly had sold out.
Right.
And a lot of, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, if you sold out, you get to keep your crown.
Right.
You know, and it maybe even a nominal way, but. Yeah.
Of course, they had to murder a few of them to get to that point. But oh goodness, yeah, I've never thought about that. Making the world safe for democracy. That is really ironic.
In the protocols it says that voting will put us on the throne of the world. But to go over the purpose of the true purpose of the war, one was to restructure the world. Of course, you had the Ottoman Empire was wiped out, Russia was wiped out, Germany was dismembered, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was wiped out. So they restructured Europe, and then they set up the League of Nations. That was their next purpose, was to have a world government to oversee this new world order that they were creating. And, of course, it was Woodrow Wilson who proposed the League. And when the U.S. Senate rejected the Versailles Treaty, which created the League, and so America didn't enter, that's when they created the Council on Foreign Relations. Right out of that, it was directly created as a result of the Senate's rejection of the Versailles Treaty, Council on Foreign Relations being to bring America to change its climate of opinion to would accept world government. Another purpose, of course, was the Bolshevik Revolution. And you know all about how Wilson and Churchill got Trotsky released from Halifax, Canada, even though the Bolsheviks were going to pull Russia out of the war. That's what they promised, and that would mean the Germans would shift soldiers to the Western Front and kill more Americans and British and Canadians. They put the success of the Russian Revolution above that, and you know all about the financing from Kuhn Loeb also being one of Wilson's top financial backers, along with Cleveland Dodge.
They actually subsidized him when he was president of Princeton, and they are the ones that got him that position, so that he would look like a good presidential candidate. When they find people that will work with them, they will put them in power. They're the ones that
absolutely. This guy was groomed. And you're right,
sure.
Cleveland Dodge was his classmate in the class of 79 at Princeton, so they went way back.
Yeah.
Another purpose, of course, was that we needed to get to this was the Balfour Declaration, whereby Britain promised the Zionists that they would secure the Jews a national homeland in Palestine. And, of course, the irony is that Britain had no authority in Palestine whatsoever. Palestine had been under the control of the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, for 400 years, and that's, in my opinion, the most probable reason they invaded Palestine, and why you had the movie Lawrence of Arabia and T. Lawrence did not know that they're going to betray the Arabs, but the Arabs were promised Palestine if they would help the British throw off the Turks. But what they didn't know is behind their backs, Alfred Balfour, 33rd degree Freemason, would sign this document to Walter Rothschild, a private banker with no government position, promising that Britain would give the Jews a homeland in Palestine, which was, ultimately it's a satanic thing. It's all about creating the throne of the Antichrist, which I won't try to elaborate on now, but it's not about creating a godly state or something biblical. Before I throw it back to you, Dan, I just want to mention one of these coincidental dates, which is that the Balfour Declaration was issued on November the 2nd, and 5 days later, November the 7th, the Bolsheviks overthrew Kerensky's regime, which meant that Russia would no longer be a British ally. My suspicion, and maybe I'm wrong here, is that because Britain was going to lose an ally when the Bolsheviks took over, they wanted to make sure they had that Bolshevik, they had the Balfour Declaration public and official before Lenin made his final move to take over Russia, which would take it out of the war.
Exactly. Oh, yes. That's why these timelines are so important. I think that it really puts everything into place, kind of a roadmap to world power. Interesting.
And there's one other thing in that timeline which I find fascinating, which is that And this was brought to my attention, and I was reading the book, The Secret World Government, by Count Arthur Chepsberdovich, who was a Russian major general and a friend of the Tsar. He said that he believed that America's entry into the war was delayed until the Tsar abdicated. And if you look at it, the Tsar abdicated March the 15th, 1917. Wilson asked for that declaration of war on just 18 days later, April the 2nd, 1917. So it looks as if they were thinking, if America comes into the war, that's going to strengthen the Entente. The Tsar's position will be bolstered, and maybe he won't step down. They wanted to make sure that he abdicated. Then America was to come into the war and fulfill that pledge that we get the Balfour Declaration.
Oh.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah,
very, very
right.
closely associated. So that's why your timeline, I think, is vital, because when you see the sequence of these dates, things start to make a lot more sense.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. Yes, of course. And sometimes we don't think about all of these events and how one plays off against another. And Russia actually went out of the war, so they would not be a part of, there were some other reasons, too, that they left the war, which we don't have time to explore. This whole thing is so well planned out. All the warfare, all the wars, the dates, the times, the people that are used, the people that they're all planning these in boardrooms, while the rest of us are just trying to put food on the table, a roof over our head, and trying to take care of our kids, and they're planning major battles that impact all of us. And of course we still have these silent wars, these wars that are going on that impact all of us, and we don't even recognize it. War doesn't happen just with bullets and guns and tanks and planes. We are at war all the time against.
All you have to do is turn on your television. You know there's a war on your soul that's taking place. You're right. It's cultural. It's political, even some sense religious or spiritual, as well as the militaristic side of war.
Right. It's amazing. Well, I certainly thank you for, let's see, I think we have maybe another caller. Nope, we don't have another caller. Okay. Well, I really, really like your article. And all the work that you put into it. And I hope that people will purchase your book and the name of that book. And you can get it on Amazon, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, Unmasking the Forces Behind Global Destruction. And it is global destruction. And wonderful. And it is available as a Kindle, which is a very good searchable book, as well as a paperback book. And some of the things that you cover in that book, you talk about the devil as a banker, how the cartel has run America, the planned state, you cover Vietnam, you cover the media, the destruction of nations, Satan's control structure. You talk about Freemasonry. You talk about Zionism, environmentalism. You talk about 9/11, the purposes of the Iraq War, the arts, the war on faith, the most hidden book. You talk about the protocols and the myths of free trade. I just received a book from somebody in Canada about free trade that we're going to be covering in a future program. But anyway, thank you so very much for all the work that you've done. And your first book, let's just mention your first book, The Shadows of Power, that you wrote in 1988. And it was probably one of the first books that I received, and it is called The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations and the American Decline. And you wrote this, as I said, back in 1988. I have it highlighted, a lot of post-it notes in it. So So anyway, you've been around doing this kind of thing for quite some time, and I really appreciate that. So, any
last words? Just motivated by a desire for truth, and you know, it seems that in our culture, because there's so many lies, to tell people the truth, you have to spend a lot of time disproving the lies. And that's what you and me are both about, and what I know your listeners are also about too. And I know you have a very informed audience out there. And so, and again, I just want to thank you, Diana. It wasn't until I started looking at your books just this past week that I understood your achievements as an author. I've, you know, looked on you as a radio show host, hosting me, and I appreciate that so much. But you are to be appreciated. So I just want to commend people to be buying your books, The Ruling Elite. I'm so delighted to hear the third one's out, and that you even have another one on the way. And I don't know where you get the time. It takes me so much time to write a 250-page book. How do you get the time to write two 700-page books? I have no idea. But you are to be commended, the detail, the amount of work you've done. When people are motivated by doing right, they work pretty hard, and it's obvious that you've done that.
And so have you. Well, thank you so very much for being on the program today, and we'll talk soon. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much, Diana.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners.